What is up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Locked On Vikings. It is your daily source for Vikings news and analysis and all the updates surrounding your Minnesota Vikings. I'm your host, I'm your pal, I'm the kid you copied off in math class. My name is Luke Braun. You can find me on Twitter at LukeBraunNFL. You can find the show on Twitter at Locked On Vikings as well. And hey, if you're the kind of person who likes to listen to this on your commute in the car, or you just don't like digging through clunky podcast apps on your phone or other smart device, you can ask it to just play podcast Locked On Vikings. It'll find the most recent episode for you. You don't have to lift a finger. That's play podcast Locked On Vikings. And that also worked for play podcast Locked On NFL or play podcast Locked On Draft. Works for all of them. It's a super neat thing. We have a whole bunch to talk about, and it's only the first day of tampering, so I am just going to jump right into it. The tampering period opened with the Vikings making a whole bunch of housekeeping moves, really expected easy stuff, and some small yet still important moves to make. And since this is a daily podcast, we have the bandwidth to talk about all of them. So first, let's talk about a couple of the restricted free agent tenders that the Vikings placed on a couple of players and what that means. So I've explained this on the show before, but if you're new or you just want a refresher real quick, it means that the Vikings have placed an offer essentially to this player. They are free to negotiate with other teams, but if another team offers them a contract, the Vikings get a chance to match it before that player signs on the dotted line. And if they sign on the dotted line anyways, or if the Vikings don't match it, the other team gets or has to give up possibly a draft pick, depending on the kind of tender. So we'll start with Anthony Harris, who has a second-round tender. So if that happens and Anthony Harris leaves to go with the other team, that team has to give up a second-round draft pick to the Vikings to take him. Otherwise, and most teams don't really touch it, so the most likely scenario is that we pay Anthony Harris $3 million, a little bit more than $3 million, to be our starting safety for the 2019 season, which is a steal looking at the other safety contracts that went out. You know, Landon Collins made $84 million over 6 years. We'll see what the guarantees and stuff are, and all that contract structure stuff matters a lot, but we're just working with base numbers here in this, the kind of first day of all of it and all the initial reactions. Tyrann Mathieu got a huge deal. Like, the safety market is paying. Kenny Vaccaro, it's paying. And it's fortuitous that the Vikings are in a situation where they had an undrafted free agent, like, play at a starting quality level and allow them to lock that guy up at an actual tender and keep that deal cheap in a world where people are paying out the nose for safeties. The other restricted free agent tender went to tackle Rashad Hill. So this is a pretty low octane move, in my opinion. It's a $2 million deal. Unlike with Anthony Harris, if somebody were to offer Rashad Hill a better deal and if he were to take it without the Vikings matching, the Vikings don't get a draft pick in return because it's original round and Rashad Hill was undrafted, so there is no draft pick. So theoretically, somebody could come in and offer Rashad Hill, you know, $10 million a year and he could leave and we could still lose him. However, if he signs the tender, he is now under contract for about $2 million a year. Now, swing tackles, which is basically what Rashad Hill would be, he'd be a swing backup tackle, make usually like $3.5 to $6 million. It's an important position that teams tend to spend on, so getting that for $2 million is also like an efficient deal. And in terms of production, I don't think he's a starter. I spoke a lot about that if you were following my writings during the 2018 season. You know, I thought that they should have put in Brian O'Neill a lot quicker because of, you know, he had shown something in the preseason, he had been showing things in practice, and I don't think it should have taken an injury for them to make that switch. But as a backup, your standards change, and the evaluation changes when you're saying, is he good enough to, you know, come in for two games when somebody's in the concussion protocol? And I think the answer to that is a resounding yes, especially at a $2 million paycheck. It would be an excellent deal. Now, there has been a little bit of unrest about these two particular moves because it feels a little dangerous, especially if you're hearing about the restricted free agent process for the first time. When I heard about it for the first time, which was like not that long ago, I remember thinking, wow, like if I were another team, I would exploit the heck out of that. I would go in and, you know, offer like $2.5 million to Rashad Hill and make the other team match it, you know, and I'm not interested in Rashad Hill, but it would still be a good deal if I did get him. And if I didn't, I'm making my rival spend a little bit more money, you know. I would do that kind of thing all the time. It never happens. And I think the reasons are twofold, especially with draft pick tenders. Nobody is going to try to trade a second round pick for Anthony Harris. Golden Tate just went for a third rounder. Antonio Brown just went for a third and a fifth. Like, these teams value their draft picks. They are not going to blow a two on Anthony Harris. But even with an original round tender like Rashad Hill, maybe somebody views him as more valuable than $2 million and is willing to try to go outbid that. But you don't want to be in a bidding war with a team when you're at a disadvantage. And with the tendering system, the team that's letting that guy go, the team that has the rights to him and the first right of refusal, has a huge advantage in the bidding war. The thing about like a normal bidding war is you don't know how much higher that next guy is willing to go. But with this tender thing, you kind of have to tip your cards right away. Like if it were just a regular bidding war over a regular unrestricted free agent, you know, okay, I want 5 million and you say no 10 million and I say no 15 million. And if you want to go up to 16 million or 20 million, like you don't know where my limits are. So you kind of have to guess, or you kind of have to go incrementally, and then there's risk to that, because if you go too slow, they might just leave you in the dust and blow the guy away with a huge offer. There's all kinds of like dynamics to bidding wars that kind of make it a game within the game itself. But with the tender, you kind of just have to place your cards on the table right away and say, okay, here's the offer. And if the team matches, they match. And if they don't, they don't. You have like no information to go off of. So it's kind of a loser's game if you wanted to go in and start messing with people's restricted free agent tenders. And the second reason is that these are undrafted free agents that are very often backups. I think situations like an Anthony Harris are very rare, or like Adam Thielen a couple years ago. That kind of thing is very rare, where it's a guy that people really would have interest in if they did their homework and did their scouting. And I don't, like, that's why they put draft pick tenders on those guys, right? Because, like, somebody might actually be interested in Anthony Harris. But with, like, Rashad Hill, if I'm a team looking for a tackle, perhaps I think that Rashad Hill is going to be, you know, underpaid this year, and maybe I can give him a slightly better deal and take him out from under. But, like, if I'm a team looking for a tackle, I'm looking at, like, Juwan James, and I'm looking at, like, Trent Brown, who signed for a huge deal today. Like, I'm looking for actual names out there. And I think these tender guys tend to, like, fly under the radar a little bit more. So I understand why it would make you a little nervous, because there's nothing stopping a team from like coming in and screwing up with that delicate balance, but it's a super rare event, and it's not a super rare event by accident. Teams just don't tend to play that game because it's really, really hard to win it, and there's easier ways to fill your needs. So I would say that the smart money bets on those guys playing out those deals and being really efficient contracts. So there's a lot more news to talk about, some cap clearing moves and one signing, and we're gonna get into all of it later in the show, but first I am going to step away for a quick ad break. Thank you all so much for hanging out, and I'll see y'all in a minute. All right, we are back. So to make room for those two tenders we just talked about, as well as some other miscellaneous stuff, the Vikings made a couple of cap clearing moves on Monday morning. This is all stuff we expected a lot, so I'm not going to talk too much about the merits of it, but I do want to talk about the kind of legacies of these two players, because they will be leaving. Andrew Sandejo had his option declined, which means his contract technically is now expiring and he leaves for free agency naturally. Mike Remmers has been cut with a very weird failed physical designation, which we'll get into in a second. But first, let's talk about Andrew Sandejo. So his option was declined. We described this on a previous podcast, but real quick, that means that it's not the same as like releasing someone. He counts toward the compensatory pick formula because it went down this way, which is good for the Vikings. It means they may get something back for him. But I wanted to talk a little bit about just his legacy here, because he played in Minnesota for a really long time. And I think it warrants a look at his career here, because he started as an undrafted free agent out of Rice, and he came into the league. He played in Sacramento for the Mountain Lions of the UFL after he didn't get drafted and he didn't make a team his first year, and then eventually he ends up in Dallas for a hot second, and then eventually he ends up in Minnesota, and he works his way up. He beats out, you know, Jamarcus Sanford and Tyrell Johnson. He beats out these guys that were kind of shuffling, or Hussein Abdullah, these guys that were like shuffling around at the safety position to try to be like the guy next to Harrison Smith, or just the guy period for a while. And he ends up getting the start over, I think Robert Blanton was the last guy that played safety next to Smith, besides Sandejo. And he gets the start and he struggles, and he wasn't very good for his first, you know, couple of games. And he really developed over time. And it's a really unique thing to see, because by and large, the players who are good stay good and the players who are bad stay bad. That's not to say that there can't be an increase or a decline, or, you know, stuff happens all the time. But by and large, you know, an undrafted free agent, the large majority of undrafted free agents, like, struggle to make teams and flame out of the league after a while. And a huge chunk of, like, the first round draft picks, you know, huge talents, they all end up having long careers in the league. And to see a guy break that mold, and to do so in such a unique way, like, you know, we miss on in the draft all the time, and some guy will fall out of the draft and end up being a superstar. That happens all the time, but it's usually pretty clear right away that, like, oh, he is something and he's going to make it. Anderson Dejo had to fight through tertiary football leagues. I mean, everybody playing in the AAF is going to look at that story and see inspiration in it. And he went through, you know, trying to make the team and maybe not making the team. And then he gets a contract that at the time was pretty good for him. And now he's going to hit the free agent market at a time when the safety market is exploding, but it's also very saturated. I'm actually super curious to see what kind of money he's going to get. And that is also, like, interesting if you're just worrying about it for the benefit of the Vikings, because it could mean, like, a low-level compensatory pick, and that's not nothing. Like, as a frame of reference, the Vikings actually would have gotten a seventh-round compensatory pick for Shamar Stephen last year because of the contract he signed with Seattle. We'll talk about him in a second, don't worry. But the point is, there actually is a chance that Anderson Dejo does, like, return a draft pick in the 2020 draft, and that would really mean a lot. Those can really add up. But overall, I think he should be remembered here in Minnesota as a guy who steadily improved year over year over so many years that he actually became a good player by the end of it. I mean, in the 2017 and the few games in 2018 that he played, he could really ball, and he was really playing well. I think he actually peaked in the playoffs in 2017 in that Saints game. He was playing amazingly before he got a concussion and got hurt. He's a good player, and in a world where guys are throwing, you know, $10, $15 million a year for these huge six-year contracts at free agent safeties, somebody's going to end up having to quote-unquote settle for Anderson Dejo, and I think they're going to be really happy with the deal that they got, because they won't have to pay top dollar with him being kind of a tier below like Earl Thomas and Landon Collins. His market value right now is probably well below his actual quality of play. Somebody's going to be really happy with it. Now, that doesn't mean that the Vikings were wrong to let him go. They had an even more efficient deal in the whole Anthony Harris thing I just explained, and they don't really have room to pay $5.5 million to their backup safety. They need that money for other things, namely fixing the offensive line, trying to retain, you know, a guy like Sheldon Richardson. And I think when you can clear that much money without actually creating a hole at any position or really mandating that anybody be replaced, it's really behooves you to do it. So moving on to the other guy that was released, actually properly released, Mike Remmers. So Mike Remmers will not count against the compensatory pick formula. Somebody could give him a huge premier offensive tackle contract. The Vikings wouldn't get anything back. They eat about a $1.8 million of dead cap, but they save, I think, a total of 4.5 net after accounting for that dead cap. So I think with Remmers, like with Sendejo, the lesson to be learned was never count out an undrafted free agent. I think that's the lesson there, right? Those guys can always find a way to develop, and, you know, these teams with these, like, long-term plans with guys, if somebody is as good as they are, you know, and they can't quite make the team in their first year after not going drafted, and the team intends to stick with them for 3 years, hey, maybe that guy is going to be a little better. I think we learned the same thing with Anthony Harris, too. With Mike Remmers, we learn a lesson, but it's a much different one, and it's don't move tackles to guard, especially if they're career tackles that have never played there. Mike Remmers just doesn't have the tools to play guard. And I think, honestly, a lot of Vikings fans, and maybe even the Vikings themselves, learned a really bad lesson from Mike Harris. If you remember, a couple years ago, Mike Harris was a middling swing tackle. He was, like, maybe good enough to be a backup. I actually remember thinking he wouldn't make the team that year, but they switched him to guard in OTAs, and he turned out to be, like, really good at it. The thing about it is that now everybody who is, like, not that good at tackle, people just say, move him to guard, it'll fix all the problems. But as we've talked about on a previous show, actually go listen to that one. I'm trying to recap points as much as possible so you don't have to dig through old shows. But go listen to the position switching offensive line episode if you're more curious about this. There's a lot of differences between playing tackle and playing guard. And if you've never played guard, or if you haven't played guard since, you know, college or since high school or whatever, that means that is going to be a tough transition. Mike Remmers could not make that transition. There was one particular problem with tackles. You can kind of be a little slower with your hands. So he has this habit of quote-unquote holstering his hands. This is something that I've heard Arif Hassan talk about on podcasts and at The Athletic all the time. And essentially that means that instead of just pushing your hands out directly, he kind of, like, puts it to his hip first and then pushes it out, and it takes him longer for his hands to get to the spot they're supposed to get to. At tackle, that doesn't really matter, because there's usually two or three steps before the point of contact anyways, right? An edge rusher is going to kind of run upfield a little, or run, you know, try to make a move or try to spin or something. And there's a little time to kind of get your hands situated, and it's more about being precise with timing. It's almost a good habit for tackles, just because it means, you know, you can kind of time out more precisely when you hit the edge rusher. With a tackle, you throw your hands too early and you've lost, so you kind of have to try to avoid that. with guards, you're basically shooting directly out of your stance and trying to get your hands on that guy as fast as possible. It's really hard to throw your hands too early as a guard, so that habit just becomes damaging. It's really easy to throw your hands too late as a guard because your hands just have to be up more quickly. And Mike Remmers had that problem, and it caused a whole bunch of issues throughout 2018. You know, watching him play guard, we all know that he struggled a lot. He gave up a bunch of pressures, a bunch of sacks. It was not a good fit for him. Meanwhile, Brian O'Neill developed. And, you know, I think Mike Remmers could probably still play tackle at a reasonable level, certainly starting quality, maybe even like average or above it. And I think similarly to Sendejo, I think someone's going to get a deal because his market value was just tanked by having a really bad season in 2018 and getting cut. Teams are going to look at that and be really wary. But I think if somebody is smart enough to grab him, put him back to right tackle where he belongs, and let him, you know, get back into the swing of things there, he's going to be good for some team. And I'm rooting for him. I'm rooting for Sendejo. I root for all the players that leave the Vikings. I think it just makes me happy when players do well. But I think there's just a lesson to be learned there about not immediately assuming that NFL players are going to pick something up that they've never done before or that they haven't done in a very long time. There's a lot of risk associated with that, and the Vikings have taken that risk a lot before, and we all look at Mike Harris as the one time when it worked out, but it fails really often. And one last, like, addendum quickly on Mike Remmers. He was cut with a failed physical designation, which is very strange. He was playing through a lower back injury in the final game of the season against the Bears, but he did play through that whole game, and so a failed physical is very weird. I actually am not familiar enough with the CBA and the specifics of contracts to know why a failed physical designation would be the thing here. But it'll be interesting to see as he goes to his next team, you know, does he pass the like required physical that you have to pass to get into a contract with a new team, or what the deal with that is, or if that means that the Vikings save some cash or something like that. It's a suspicious situation, and I don't know enough of the details. I apologize about like physicals and, you know, cutting veteran players this time of year and what the rules surrounding that are, but it's definitely a situation to watch as it plays out, because the Vikings do kind of tend to pull weird stuff like this to gain, you know, generate little advantages here and there. And it might be something interesting, but for now, we're going to move on to some of the bigger news. I do have to step away for a second ad break, but after that, we're going to look into some of the bigger stuff. The Vikings signed a player, and a very important Viking signed somewhere else. So we will talk about that in a second. All right, let's get into the good stuff, everybody. So we'll start with a small move. The Vikings made a small depth signing, and I wanted to touch on it real quick, and then we'll talk about the big thing. But Shamar Stephen is returning to the Minnesota Vikings. This is a move that I hadn't really considered, but in hindsight, it does make a whole bunch of sense. The Vikings have really liked this guy. He was part of Mike Zimmer's first draft, and now he's back on the team. He left for Seattle for a year, but I don't think the Vikings wanted to let him go. I mean, I remember when they took him on the roster over Fred Evans, a guy who had been there for a lot of years, and he fended off like other challenges all the time. He fended off challenges from guys like Dayton Jones and all kinds of, you know, like aspiring interior linemen, and the Vikings consistently liked him better. And I think one of the things they like about him is that he plays both the three tech and the nose position, so he could theoretically back up Linval Joseph and Sheldon Richardson or whoever the three tech ends up being. From a production angle, just looking at like the Pro Football Focus page, Shamar Stephen is known as a run stop guy. He only had 9 run stops on 227 snaps. That's not very good for the 2018 season, but for the 2017 season, I think he was a lot better. He got 6.3 run stop percentage. It's 12 run stops on 189 snaps. That's much more efficient. That's actually pretty close to like what Jaron Reed did over there, and I really like him actually as a young player in Seattle. He's really nothing compared to like what Linval Joseph was doing or anything, and remember, this is a guy who's a backup. We haven't seen the money yet, but it'll probably be somewhere between $1 and $2 million. That's what he's been making over the course of most of his career. So I think that people kind of lost it when this happened. Like, this is what you've been working on? This is the grand thing? But I don't think that the Vikings are, like, trying to sell it as that. I mean, they're not trying to sell it at all right now. There's been no media surrounding it because this is all legal tampering still. But, like, I don't think we need to really view this as the Vikings' plan. You got to get depth. You need backups, right? That, like, they're not going to make or break the season, but they're still things you have to do, and the Vikings are doing them. And remember, just because it happened before everything else doesn't mean it was the thing that the Vikings were prioritizing the most. They might have already had this deal drafted up through like back alley illegal tampering stuff, which teams do all the time. So trust me, don't stress about what the Vikings did at backup interior defensive line. A lot of people are saying, oh, this means they aren't signing Sheldon Richardson. I kind of disagree with that because, like, say the Vikings do re-sign Sheldon Richardson, they still kind of needed a backup because Jahlil Johnson wasn't really getting it done. He's more of a nose tackle guy. Shamar Stephen would be able to be that backup three tech that, like, Jalen Holmes, we don't know if he's, like, so bringing Shamar Stephen into camp makes sense even if they do have Richardson, and it definitely makes sense if they don't. So I don't know if we can really discern anything from this move. I think we were going in, the rumors were telling me it was like a 50-50 thing with Richardson, and I still kind of feel like it's a 50-50 thing, but by and large, it's just a depth move. And it's one that makes a lot of sense. The guy knows the scheme. They have a really high opinion of him, and they'll probably be able to get him for a lot cheaper than they think he's worth. So it makes sense for them to do it. I don't really think this moves any other needles. So we'll not get too wrapped up into that. Let's go into the big news, which is that Anthony Barr signed with the Jets. He's going to be a New York Jet, and he signed for somewhere in the $14 to $15 million range. This news is breaking literally as I'm recording. Like, as I was talking about Sendejo, this news was breaking. So I don't have all the exact numbers or anything, and you probably know more listening to this a day in the future than I do right now, but here's what I have to work with. Anthony Barr is going to sign with the Jets. It's going to be a $14 to $15 million a year deal. That means a third round compensatory pick for the Vikings, assuming they don't bring a free agent that fits in that tier as well, assuming they don't, you know, bring in some $15 million guard or something, which, considering their cap situation, is pretty unlikely. They'll probably just get that third-round compensatory pick, and that's not nothing. I don't know if I would trade Anthony Barr for a year-delayed third-round pick, but it's better than losing him for nothing, and he makes the huge payday that the Vikings were never going to be able to keep up with. And the rumors out of New York are that they're going to use him. They run a 3-4 over there. It's Greg Williams, and they're going to use him kind of like the way I guess that he tried to use Jamie Collins. They're going to use him as a pass rusher. He's going to play the Von Miller, Justin Houston role that I think a lot of people here wanted him to play. And it'll be really interesting to see, because I personally, and the people that like evaluate the draft really, really well, they're all telling me that, no, this guy's not an edge player. He's a blitzer. He's maybe the best blitzer in the league, but he's an off-ball linebacker that blitzes, not an edge rusher that covers sometimes. There's a difference between those two things. He doesn't have the bend. He doesn't have the skill set to beat tackles consistently, but he does have the skill set to beat tight ends and running backs consistently or get around guards on a blitz, not to mention the smarts to execute a system like Mike Zimmer's. So we'll see how Greg Williams uses him. I do not have a very high opinion of Greg Williams as a defensive coordinator. I think a lot of players have played their worst football under him. And I sincerely hope that that's not true of Anthony Barr. I hope he thrives there, and I want him to become a superstar because I like the guy. He was always pure class when he was here. He always said the right things. He always, you know, kept his head down, and he played his butt off through a weird contract situation where it was always nebulous and we were never sure what was going to happen. And I mean, looking around the league, you see what like Brown and Antonio or Le'Veon Bell are doing, and you see that Anthony Barr could have behaved that way and he didn't, and I think we owe it to him to appreciate that. We'll see if he thrives as an edge rusher. I think that he's best in coverage and playing in space and using that range and flying from sideline to sideline and stopping horizontal plays. That's where I think he's at his best. But we'll see if the Jets use him that way or if they try something else, and we'll see how it works. I'm excited to see how all of that plays out. But this is also the first like major Mike Zimmer star to leave. I mean, they've lost like Captain Munnerlyn and stuff, but you know, Anthony Barr was Mike Zimmer's first draft pick as the head coach of the Minnesota Vikings. He's said all the time, he's like, I love Barr. I like him as a person. I think he has a really emotional relationship with Anthony Barr. So I'm sure losing him is really hard for Zimmer. But as some of the reporting happened last week, and as we've been talking about on the show a little bit, we kind of knew that this was coming. We saw that he was trying to get edge rusher money, and edge rushers make more money than off-ball linebackers. Anthony Barr has always wanted to pass rush. He's actually been pretty vocal about that. He said, I like pass rushing. I want to be more of a pass rusher. But, you know, and then he'd like backtrack it and say the right thing. But, you know, coach knows best and I'll do what coach asks me to do. But he wants to be a pass rusher. And if the Jets do that for him and the Vikings wouldn't, then it only makes sense that he would go to a team that lets him, A, play the position he wants to play, and B, pay him more to do it. So I don't think that his departure is a slight to the Vikings or anything. And hey, if things don't work out for the Jets in the way that I'm talking about, if he does move to edge rusher and it turns out that all those skills come out and he's not as good at it as we thought, and the Jets cut him early and screw up the contract, then you know what? There's always going to be a part of me that roots for that outcome, that roots for the return of Vikings, kind of a la Shamar Steven, except for a much more important guy. So in the coming episodes, we'll look at how the Vikings are going to try to replace this guy. We'll see if they try to look at a free agent, or if they don't, we'll start talking about, you know, the Devins and the other linebackers in the draft and Blake Cashman and stuff. But for now, that is going to do it for this episode of Locked On Vikings. That's all the news that I have on my phone, at least at this moment. I'm sure more stuff is going to keep breaking throughout the night and throughout the next couple days. We'll talk about it as we know about it on this show. But for now, thank you guys so much for listening. As always, you can find me on Twitter at LukeBraunNFL. You can find the show on Twitter at Locked On Vikings. You can always find the show by just asking your smart device to play podcast Locked On Vikings. It works for any Locked On show. Thank you all so much for listening. This is going to be a really crazy week. We got two more shows left on it, and I can't wait to share all this news with you guys. I will see you all tomorrow, and as always, Skol.